The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, amidst talk of a political pact, Katie Balls analyses the threat that reform posed to the Conservatives. Alexander Rawbo takes us through the MAGA social scene and the topsy-turvy world of the art collective Remilia. Reviewing Vatican Spies from the Second World War to Pope Francis by Yvonik de Noël, Damien Thompson says it's scandalous that such a high number of priests have acted as communist moles. Declaring the rest is booze, Daisy Dunn reviews the Intoxicating History podcast from Henry Jeffries and Tom Parker Bowles, as well as the art history show Moving Pictures on BBC Radio 4. And finally, Mark Mason provides his notes on obituaries. Up first, Katie Balls.
In 1603, James VI managed to do what few thought possible. The self-styled first king of Great Britain succeeded in bringing the old enemies of Scotland and England under one monarch. The union of the crowns is a topic of chatter and inspiration for the British right these days. Admirers of Nigel Farage now talk about the James First model. The idea is simple. Could the two warring tribes of the Conservatives and Reform be brought together under one leader? The next general election may be nearly 4 years away, but it's telling that such conversations are already taking place. With every new opinion poll, Conservative MPs grow a little more anxious. The Tories often poll third behind Reform and Labour. They worry that by the time they go to the polls, they will have little claim to being the main opposition. A YouGov poll this week put Reform ahead of both main parties for the first time. While that's also a problem for Starmer, the more immediate threat is to Kemi Badenoch. As she prepares to mark 100 days as Tory leader, there is growing concern that the path to recovery is narrowing. Let's be honest, it's not going well, says a former minister. Kemi doesn't have to do policy, says a senior Conservative, but she does need to do something. As the party struggles financially, staff members have been told they may have to move from their Westminster campaign headquarters. I think the Tories moving out of Matthew Parker Street should be the least of their worries, says a Reform source. Badenoch addressed aides this week about the scale of the challenge ahead, effectively telling them to buck up. It wasn't exactly a charm offensive. I wouldn't call it uplifting, says one attendee. Without a change in fortunes, Tory MPs fear they may have to work for Farage to find a route back to power. I can't see how we drag the reform vote down enough, says a former number 10 aide. Their vote is way too sticky. While the reform party has a ceiling, a vote split three or even four ways will benefit the insurgent party in a first-past-the-post system. Some Tories have concluded that as the election gets closer, the situation could get worse for them. Better to form an alliance sooner rather than later. But the official line from both camps is no. Badenoch has said Farage wants to destroy the Tories, so a merger is off the table. Reform Party aides are also rather down on the whole thing. It would be politically toxic, says a senior party figure. The Conservatives are yesterday's news. Yet some lower in the ranks are starting to air the idea, even publicly. Speaking on GB News this week, former Tory Cabinet Minister Jacob Rees-Mogg said the two parties need to strike a non-aggression pact if they want to deliver a right-wing government. If we enter the next election in this three-horse race without a pact, we may well see Labour keep its majority and just look how badly they're governing. The Reform MP Rupert Lowe has said his party would have to be very careful of our brand, stating that some type of alliance would only be a success if you remove most of the Tory party central office and you get rid of your Lib Dem MPs. In private, informal discussions have taken place with figures in both parties. The argument advanced by those privy to the talks is that the next election will probably be closer than the last, yet the prospect of Farage in government could galvanise the left to get behind Starmer rather than risk a vote for smaller parties. It's not gone unnoticed that the Greens and Lib Dems won 19% of the vote in the 2024 election, says one Tory sympathetic to a pact. If Farage is running, the left will rally behind Labour to stop him, so the winning party will need more like 37% of the vote to govern than 31%. What would a Tory reform pact look like? There are different options depending on each side's appetite for risk. The first option is the mildest, an unofficial deal similar to the way Labour and the Lib Dems approach the 2024 election. In seats where neither party has a realistic chance of winning, they field a paper candidate to give the other party a better shot. Then they hope for tactical voting in these seats to get Labour out. Then there's the geographical pact. In this scenario, seats in different areas could be divided between Tory and Reform candidates. It would be a north-south pact, provinces versus towns, says one insider. While Team Farage is probably against all this, some Conservatives believe he could be convinced. After all, he is only starting from 5 MPs. Even if a non-merger deal, for Farage to have 100 to 150 MPs, that would give him permanent power. As for a full merger, which could see Farage fulfil his ambition to do what a different Reform Party did in Canada after the 1993 Conservative wipeout, well, a name is already doing the rounds. The Reformed Conservative Party has a nice ring to it, says a Tory. But the idea is sure to encounter resistance. Andrew Mitchell, a former Conservative minister, warns against any rash behaviour. The right way is not to get into bed with Reform or worse, but to come up with the right policies to persuade those who deserted us at the last election that we have done the necessary work to develop the right policies and they can return to us. For now, this is Badenoch's approach. The general feeling is that while she is in charge, the Tories will stay away from Farage. I'm not sure you could fit both their egos in one room, says a Tory MP. Instead, MPs say a pact is only likely to work with a leader more sympathetic to Reform, such as Robert Jenrick or Suella Braverman. However, any leader would face the same danger. The Tory who makes a deal with Farage risks anointing their successor.
That was Katie Balls. Now, Alexander Robo.
The MAGA social scene was defined on the eve of Donald Trump's inauguration by the Coronation Ball, perhaps the most exuberant celebration of the new golden age. The principal speaker was, unsurprisingly, Steve Bannon, the architect of Trump's first victory and the voice of the neo-reactionary core of the president's movement. More surprising, perhaps, though, was the ball's principal sponsor, Remilia Corporation, a conceptual art movement. It was as if a Reform UK rally was sponsored by the Turner Prize. After Bannon's speech, a representative of Remilia, an artist operating behind the pseudonym LB Dobis, stood at the podium to speak about internet art and to outline Remilia's plans to remake the world one meme at a time. Founded in 2021 by Charlotte Fang, also a pseudonym, Fang is a man, Remilia emerged from an online group chat mostly made up of art school graduates and dropouts. What began as an experiment in social media performance art rapidly evolved into an enterprise spanning NFTs, meme coins, a health supplement brand, an influencer agency, a record label, and a quarterly magazine of net art criticism. What made this possible was Remilia's NFT collection, Milady, now valued at $160 million. With the birth of Milady, Remilia's army of posters had an instantly recognizable identity, blending the trends of our times, cutesy anime and digital outsider art and money. Anyone with the right aesthetic, a high tolerance for flippancy, and a good meme game could join in. Remilia's user base expanded beyond net artists and crypto developers, attracting fashion students, online Catholics, cosplayers, figures from New York Dime Square scene, and Estonian nationalists. Much like a religious cult, and indeed the MAGA movement itself, Remilia explicitly recruited outsiders. It acted as a home for those alienated by online cancellations and censorship. And its influence on the new conservative ecosystem is everywhere. Elon Musk tweeted a Milady meme in 2023. Ethereum co-founder Vitalik Buterin adopted one as his profile picture on X. It's even rumored that Remilia is developing NFTs for the Vatican. Remilia chimes with the subversive, mocking online culture of younger MAGA supporters. It is characterized by what Fang calls its jovial irreverence. Its style emphasizes speed, imitation, copy-pasta, copying and pasting other people's content, schizo-posting, affecting mental breakdown for emotional effect, writing in machine-translated Chinese, and referencing internet culture. It acts as a workshop for producing content which all users are encouraged to steal. The result is a deliberate obscuring of intent. This ambiguity is central to the appeal. The typical Rimmeliite is a paradox, intensely online but engaged with physical spaces. Milady raves in London, Tokyo, and New York happen often. Hypercapitalist, yet aesthetically and philosophically sophisticated. A devotee of wild club nights, but conservative in personal life. Fang and Dobis are reportedly both married. Like Trump, Rimmelia is obsessed with China, which Fang describes as the fulcrum of mutually assured technological acceleration. While Rimmelia stands to benefit from favorable crypto regulation, its public alignment with the Trump movement is perhaps best explained by their aesthetic compatibility. Trump's 2024 campaign was defined by viral images, his mugshot, his stint as a McDonald's worker, the triumphant fist pump. At the heart of Rimmelia's approach is the thinking of the British writer Nick Land, a self-described neo-reactionary who wrote the movement's Bible, The Dark Enlightenment, and whose philosophy of accelerationism has long been in vogue among Silicon Valley rightists. It posits that rapid technological progress will lead to a reconstitution of reality, one that Rimmelia intends to shape. Like futurism and vorticism, the artistic movements that embraced the disruption of the early 20th century and influenced the politics of the right, Rimmelia has an energy which matches Trump's and promises more disruption to come.
That was Alexander Robo. Next, Damien Thompson.
Since it became independent in 1929, Vatican City has been the world's smallest state. Every evening the gates close, leaving behind only 500 permanent residents. I once spent a week behind the walls as a guest in the Santa Marta Hostel where the Pope lives. At night, the deserted courtyards are thrillingly spooky. But it's during the day that they echo with the footsteps of secret agents. The Vatican has been teeming with spies since Pope started living on this 100-acre plot of land west of the Tiber when they returned from Avignon in 1377. In the 20th century, it entered a new era of espionage when the papacy was targeted by Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, and the United States. By definition, secret agents are supposed to be difficult to identify. It's doubly hard in the case of the Vatican spies, who are the subjects of the French historian Yvonique de Noël's book, because so many of them have been priests. Those employed by the church range from taciturn creatures of the Curia, George Smileys in clerical collars, to heroic clergy who take insane risks behind the lines in order to help persecuted Catholics. I say those employed by the church because since the 1930s, when Noel begins his narrative, a scandalous number of priests have infiltrated the Vatican as agents of foreign powers. Some did so because they were being blackmailed. Some were bribed. Others, especially during the Cold War, were sincere Marxists who received the Sacrament of Holy Orders on the instructions of their communist bosses. The Polish Secret Service almost certainly managed to sneak a mole into the Vatican during the Second Vatican Council. Father Jerzy Dabrowski, codenamed Ignatius, was the deputy secretary of the Polish bishops from 1963 to 1970. By the time he died in a car crash in 1991, he was an auxiliary bishop credited with facilitating the negotiations that established a democratic Poland. Not until 1997 was he named as a government agent who had fed council documents to the KGB. The Kremlin faced greater challenges recruiting Catholic priests from the largely Orthodox Soviet Union. It succeeded by inserting Lithuanian Catholic agents into the pontifical seminaries. Meanwhile, nearly every Russian Orthodox clergyman working for ecumenism with the Catholic Church was a spy. Their efforts bore spectacular fruit. In 1970, just days after President Richard Nixon met Pope Paul VI, a detailed summary of their conversations landed on the desk of the KGB chief, Yuri Andropov. Vatican spies begins with the pontificate of Pius XII. The dispute over whether his silence in the face of Nazi atrocities saved or endangered lives will never be settled. What we do know is that he hid Jews in Rome and gave his blessing to the plot to assassinate the Führer. So much for the claim that he was Hitler's Pope. On the other hand, it was during his pontificate that the Vatican helped Nazi war criminals escape to South America, so long as they converted to the Catholic faith. Naturally, they jumped at the chance. De Noël suggests that in the view of Pius XII, they were simply lost sheep who had finally opened their eyes to the teaching of the Church. Such naivety is perhaps harder to defend than his wartime silence. In the end, though, diplomacy is a nightmare for all popes, who wield enormous influence, but have to protect millions of vulnerable believers without the support of any legions. Accommodating dictators is sometimes the only alternative to a bloodbath. At other times, it betrays moral cowardice. The line between the two is perilously thin. Even John Paul II, revered for his role in toppling communism, initially placated Poland's regime before exploiting its eventual weakness to push for change. That was surely the greatest of all the Church's diplomatic triumphs. In contrast, the greatest disaster is now unfolding, and it's a weakness of De Noël's otherwise even-handed study that he does not recognise it for what it is. In 2018, the Vatican took action to end the messy anomaly of two Chinese Catholic churches, one run by the Communist Party, the other loyal to Rome and supposedly underground, though in practice the two are entangled. So it signed a deal that allowed Beijing to nominate bishops so long as Pope Francis approved them. President Xi promptly violated the agreement. The Vatican has not. As a result, Chinese communist spies are free to strut around Rome. They do not need to masquerade as official Catholic bishops because that is what they are. Their consecration is recognized by the Pope in the knowledge that their only allegiance is to Beijing. Both sides have a long-term perspective, says De Noël. The truth is that only China's perspective matters, because it's the only side moving closer to its goal, the transformation of Vatican City, still grotesquely corrupt and therefore always susceptible to blackmail, into its first European vassal state.
That was Damien Thompson, and now Daisy Dunn.
Intoxicating History is the perfect title for drinks expert Henry Jeffries and food critic Tom Parker Bowles' new podcast. Its theme is alcohol, but its contents are predominantly historical, which is good news if, like me, you are quick to apply the word bore to any man who talks about wine for more than 8 minutes. The first episodes came out before Christmas, but they've been gathering momentum since Dry January. Today's drinking culture, which has spawned this bizarre annual group sacrifice, has an interesting pedigree. Europeans have apparently been on their guard against boozing Englishmen for nearly a millennium. The Portuguese were certainly left in no doubt of our reputation when we aided them in their Reconquista. The tipsy Anglo-Normans in question were 12th century crusaders en route to the Holy Land. We did not immediately take to Portugal's own vintage. Fizzy, tannin-rich, it was also, says Jeffries, just a little bit piggy, owing to the fact that it was transported in porcine skins. The later addition of brandy not only stabilised it, but also rendered it more palatable. We heard the tragic tale of one John Mitten, who went up to Cambridge with 2,000 bottles of the stuff, left with none, and no degree, and died after drunkenly riding a bear. Port is the one drink not enjoyed by James Bond, whose love of alcohol receives its own episode. Listening to Parker Bowles describe the punchiness of Fleming's Vespa cocktail reminded me of just how supernatural Bond used to be. The Vespa was made with Gordon's gin and Smirnoff vodka at a time when the former was stronger than today. Jeffries and Parker Bowles are brilliant company. the former leading on the history of drink, the latter chiming in with surprising literary and foodie references. Parker Bowles clearly has at his bedside copies of An Instance of the Finger Post, a post-restoration thriller by Ian Pears, some histories on Thomas Cromwell, and the collective works of Dickens with bookmarks in the Pickwick Papers. He is the quieter of the pair, but thoughtful and funny. There is something of the rest is history to the podcast, though there is less obedience to chronology, more darting around the monarchs and their tables. For all the forays into Portugal and France, it feels very British and homely. It is perhaps sobering to be reminded that alcohol has never been the sole threat to our indulgent rulers. King James I, it was said, died from eating a surfeit of lampreys. Have you ever wondered what happened when, in the early ages of plumbing, the loos at court threatened to back up? According to one of the historians interviewed for the latest series of Moving Pictures on Radio 4, the residents simply left for another of their homes, allowing time for the refuse to drain away. Moving Pictures is art history's equivalent to In Our Time. Unabashedly intellectual, it examines a single painting, drawing, or tapestry in each episode. The main difference is that scholars are interviewed individually, so they don't have the chance to argue with each other. The format may be less dynamic as a consequence, but the subject matter often lends itself to a calmer, more leisurely approach. If you want to relax, close your eyes and try to picture the artwork described. If you want to learn how truly to see a picture, follow the website's link and look while you listen. The works under discussion in this series are Rembrandt's A Woman Bathing in a Stream, Joseph Wright of Derby's An Experiment on a Bird in the Air Pump, both in the National Gallery, and the War of Troy tapestry in the V&A. It's an eclectic mix. The episode on Joseph Wright of Derby's painting has the most wonderful tension to it. Will the bird survive? Does the painting show us? The episode on the tapestry features a great digression on bread-based cleaning, as well as castle plumbing. Most of all, I appreciate the series for allowing us to do what so many galleries have stopped us from doing. I often used to pop into the National Gallery when I had 10 minutes spare to seek out a particular picture. Popping in now seems like a thing of the past, with a convoluted entrance leading via security to a long circuit through the building and its gift shops. Moving Pictures may just offer the best alternative to a frustrated quest to spend some time with a single work of art.
That was Daisy Dunn. And finally, Mark Mason.
My obituaries habit gets ever stronger. I find there's nothing as inspiring or instructive or entertaining as reading a few hundred words about someone's time on this planet. My main dealers are The Times and Radio 4's Last Word. Each batch throws together a varied mix, people who share only one thing in common, the fact that they checked out at the same time. All human life is here, as it were. A good obituary knows that we want stories, not lists of achievements. Some obituaries read like sitcom scripts, like the obit of a rugby hero who played in a match between the British Army of the Rhine and the French Army. 12 players were sent off, one of them our hero, for landing a right hook on the nose of an opponent who had just bitten him on the genitals. Or the father of Michael Bond, he of Paddington, who on family holidays in the Isle of Wight would insist on wearing his hat in the sea in case he needed to raise it to anyone. Others read like thrillers. A policeman involved in the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry despaired of his boss's contempt for suggestions, such as that of a colleague who thought the killer drove a lorry because footprints showed that one of the heels was more worn than the other. Peter Sutcliffe was indeed a lorry driver. Sometimes you're left wondering. A billionaire set up a trust fund from which his children then gradually excluded him, leaving him and his wife to pen a book that ended with the line, "Our nightmare will never end." But the obit didn't really get to the bottom of why they fell out. Perhaps no one could, not even the family themselves. Families are like that. Occasionally I'll feel sad when someone's obit was the first I'd ever heard of them and I like the sound of them. As soon as they're here, they're gone, as though you've been allowed to shake their hand once and once only. But there will still be their work to check out, their films or music or whatever. And in one way, the fact they've experienced the Great Leveller makes you feel closer to them. It always reminds me of the gravestone in the crypt of St. Martin in the Fields. "Remember man as thou goest by, as thou art now, so once was I. As I am now, so must thou be. Prepare thyself to follow me. Sometimes batches of obits can produce lovely coincidences. Last year, next to each other on the same page in the Times, were Carl Wallinger, whose royalties from Robbie Williams' cover of his song She's the One got him through a serious illness, and Peter McCann, who founded the rehab clinic at which Williams himself saw a mural of some angels and was inspired to write his best-known song. The ages within a batch remind you that 70 years and 10 is just an estimate, one that comes without a guarantee. A recent page covered people who died at 89, 83 and 55. But sometimes there are pleasing patterns, Nicholas Parsons and Murray Walker dying at 96 and 97 respectively, having been born on the same day as each other in 1923. And the obit of Ken Capstick, Arthur Scargill's right-hand man, finished with the story of him texting Scargill on the day Margaret Thatcher died. The message read simply, "Thatcher dead." The reply was instant, "Scargill alive."
And that's everything for this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate a review and a follow, however you subscribe to your podcasts. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.